It's time to embark on your own heroic journey.
And the fact is, we're living in a mythic times where we are faced with overwhelming challenges on every front, but we have been trained for an earlier era.
How the Wizard of Oz can help us access our potential, plus some lean-in backlash. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. We studied the heroic myths in school, and our kids are drawn to books and games that let them access their own inner heroes and heroines. Think of Harry Potter, Bella, and just about every video game on the market. We long to be big, to do great things. Jean Houston is a widely respected philosopher and researcher, one of the founders of the Human Potential Movement. Her work with UNICEF, as advisor to presidents and first ladies, and with the UN, has taken her around the world, where she works to build community, to empower people, and train future leaders. Her new book, The Wizard of Us, uses the time-honored practice of teaching through myth, using the film version of the classic movie about Dorothy's journey to find her way back to Kansas as a metaphor for our own search for meaning.
When I am teaching, and I've worked in 108 countries at this point with the UN and other international agencies, but I find that when I am trying to help a culture develop or to begin to meet the Millennium Development Goals or any of these things, if I put it within the context of a great story, especially the different cultures' stories, I find that people will go further and faster and deeper if they feel themselves as part of this kind of mythic push, this mythic stream. How do we turn on our various capacities, most of which we do not use? We use a very small part of our human capacity. And the fact is, we're living in a mythic times where we are faced with overwhelming challenges on every front, but we have been trained for an earlier era, you see. All the heroes and heroines are called to leave an outmoded situation. It's about evolution in action. And then, of course, it takes a tornado. But what are the other tornadoes in your life? You know, whether it is divorce or illness or some kind of loss of role or experience or capacity, whatever it is, or just sheer dogged boredom, living a life of serial monotony. You know, the tornado comes along, kicks you in the pants, and off you go. So I find, you see, the metaphors in that story are so potent, so profound.
And I think there is such a hunger among people to be a hero, but it's a very difficult thing to do when you're just trying to make ends meet and living your life.
Susan, I think we have to re-mythologize our daily lives. Instead of pathologizing them, we re-mythologize them. I mean, what is more heroic or heroinic, if you will, than, you know, raising the kids, trying to make ends meet, holding a job? That is a heroic journey. I mean, we are, and that's something I try to indicate in the book, but how we begin to take that life that is being lived and also to see the deeper dimensions of it. To be a woman in this time is to have not only all the women's roles, many of the men's roles, and roles that nobody ever thought of before, but it's also being called upon to cross the great divide of otherness that separates what we used to call the patriarchy to partnership or a form of equality. And women are probably working harder now in our time than in any other time in human history.
And you do seem to point to this time. This time right now is a pivotal moment. What is it that makes you believe that?
The world that I saw, let's say, in the 1950s, the 60s, is not the same world today. My parents and grandparents and great-parents lived a very different life. And we have more challenges, I mean, the ecological challenges, which are massive and which could, frankly, cause the species, our species, to more or less diminish and die off within the next 200 years. That is not a false statistic, unfortunately. The ecological challenges, the financial disparities, and, of course, the positives, the rise of women slowly but surely and with terrible backlash, but it is happening to full... to a kind of equality with men in the whole agenda of human affairs. This is changing everything. Because with women, the emphasis is on process rather than on product, on making things cohere and develop and grow, interrelatedness, relationships, the subjective being as important as the objective, in not all, but in many cases, not in the COO of Facebook's point of view in that funny book, Leaning, which I found very funny.
You found it funny.
Very funny. Well, because it's becoming a second-rate man. You know, it really, it kind of throws out a lot of the energies and capacities and the sheer genius of women, you know, in order to be kosher in the, you know, in the sort of male-female sense of the corporation. And there's very few, well, I mean, there's a lot of people like her, but I found it to be a funny book because it was so paradoxical. So I laughed all through it. You know, I'm the daughter of a well-known comedy writer. My dad wrote the joke, Who's On First? Yeah, I'm always looking at the ironic, the absurd, and the comical, you know, and I laughed and laughed through the book.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment then, if you don't mind. Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, is exhorting women to have their place at the table, to lean into the conversations, to make their voices heard. What would you say instead?
Well, mine is reach out, of course. It's not lean in, it's reach out. It's also realize the incredible pliability of our persona and that we are not going to be locked into being second-rate men in short skirts, but that it is women's genius, women's gift, holistic, syncretic, relationship and process oriented that is actually going to save our businesses, not the whole sense of just looking for the bottom line, which is unfortunately in that case, you know, the financial form. So it is not that restrictive view. Lean in, it already seems to be that restrictive. You go in a very narrow kind of focus, whereas the world simply does not operate that way anymore. It does not. You know, when I've looked at women's business, all right, let me take you back some years ago. So Margaret Mead says, Jane, let's do anthropology in the corporation. So she takes me to corporations where women are on the rise as vice presidents or in very important positions. She says, now watch, Jane, watch how this woman braids her work. And so we watch as she stops at every desk. She's working on a quarterly report, but stops at every desk, asks about the family, talks about ideas, calls people into their, not accountability, but their capability and their story, the deeper story. And, I mean, in this particular case, the company was doing fine because of this woman. And we just, I mean, I went to enough of them with her to see the women who were really making the difference were operating out of the genius of women and not being second-rate men. And she said, and Margaret said to me, well, you know, Jean, if they really can continue doing that, she said, in another 40 years, you're going to have women as the priests, the presidents, and also the heads of companies. But to try to imitate men and do that narrow kind of focus is really going to be destructive to the self and society, because that's not the way self and society operate. And she also said, you have to look at nature. When you look at biomimetic forms of society, analogs to nature, that's when things work. And that tends to be much more of a feminine perspective.
Jean Houston is a scholar, researcher, and philosopher, and founder of the Human Potential Movement. For the past 10 years, she's worked with the United Nations Development Program, training leaders in human and cultural development as well as in social artistry, a community leadership training program she developed. Her book is The Wizard of Us, Transformation Lessons from Oz. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Coming up, more on whether women need to lean in, or whether there's more to the story, plus a profile of a woman who changed our understanding of the world. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1240. Lean In has certainly got women talking. The book by Facebook executive Sheryl Sandberg says women are the architects of their own glass ceilings, calling for women to lean in and embrace ambition and their careers instead of worrying about the challenges of balancing work and family. It's opened up an important discussion about women, work, and society. Commentator March Gallagher says it's a book she won't be reading. She's living it.
In 1999, I was earning six figures as a new attorney at a high-powered corporate law firm in Boston. I had just graduated at the top of my class and finished a prestigious federal clerkship. I worked with brilliant and competent people on complex and interesting problems for more money than anyone in my family had ever earned. I soaked up the experience and I leaned in hard. Despite working on a full plate of large corporate environmental litigation cases, I hounded partners for additional work in securities law, white-collar crime, and other areas in order to add to my knowledge base and make my skill set well-known to the partnership. I had confidence in myself, and I knew I would go far. Less than 6 months into my law firm experience, I started the day continuing my climb up the ladder. I ended the day knowing I was pregnant and that I had early-stage cervical cancer. Infertility among women who waited to make partner before starting their families was so rampant that the firm had an employee benefit of $10,000 in vitro fertilization, no questions asked. I was already 30. I was in a 10-year stable relationship, and we knew we wanted a family. More importantly, the doctors were telling me that the cervical cancer post-pregnancy treatment might make it impossible to carry a baby to term in the future. If I wanted to be a mother, now was the time. Maybe the only time. The problems of parenting while working at the firm were evident. Late nights, on-site emergency childcare, disfavored occasional work-from-home arrangements. Most women had a nanny. One nanny brought a little girl to see her mother at the firm. As the girl was getting off the elevator, she tripped and ran right past her mother into the nanny's arms. The final straw was a partner who quietly took me aside to tell me that she saw her baby 1 hour a day. I knew I couldn't do that. The firm offered 3 months paid and 3 months unpaid leave, and like most of my colleagues, I took the full six. I believe there might be options. One senior managing woman partner told young associates a great story of how she left the firm to raise her kids for over a decade. She was at the hardware store in overalls one day, picking up more paint for a home improvement project, when a partner ran into her. He encouraged her to return to the firm, which she did, rising to a leadership position. During the first few months of my life as a new mother, it became clear to me that no amount of money was worth sacrificing my most fundamental belief in my responsibility as a mother to care for my child. My husband and I moved back to upstate New York. I had cervical surgery and luckily went on to have two more children. I didn't forget my career. I hung out my shingle and began taking pro bono cases. I grew my practice into representing small businesses in zoning and planning law. Land use practice had the benefit of being primarily night meetings before local boards. I stayed home for 10 years until my youngest turned 4. I founded not-for-profits for environmental protection, land conservation, and arts education. I ran for local elected office. I volunteered for various boards and committees at the town and county level. I was appointed to the County Industrial Development Agency and became the first chairwoman in its 30-year history. Our county changed its form of government, and our first ever county executive brought a cadre of talented professionals to implement good governance and efficiency. He made vision a reality and appointed women to top leadership positions in his administration. I was asked to head up economic development, and I am now the director of business services for my county, providing the gateway and administration for economic development bonding, tax incentives, and revolving loan fund capital. Every day, I confront issues as a working mother. I have tremendous help with two dads who work from home, an involved and supportive stepmother to my children, and many grandparents within a 25-minute drive. I've learned over time not to refer to my mothering responsibilities casually in a professional context. If I can't attend a work meeting or event because I have to take a child to a medical appointment or attend a school function, I say I have another commitment. But being a working mother with a high-stress job, even with tons of support and low-needs thriving children, I still feel inadequate as a mother. And as a professional with kids, I can't give my job 120%. I can't go to every night meeting and event because that would have me out 4 to 5 nights a week. I can't work from home like I did in graduate school and law school. And as I type this one-handed, I have an 8-year-old that I haven't seen all day sitting on my lap. And that's not even getting into taking care of myself. Sure, I'd love to go to the gym 3 days a week, and I used to ride my bike 10 miles every morning. Now I steal an hour or two on the weekends, and if I can hit the gym one night a week on the way home, that's a huge accomplishment. I get up at 6 a.m. and I prep dinner before work. And that may sound self-righteous, but I must fully acknowledge the things I don't need to do. I don't make lunches. I don't do laundry. And I don't go food shopping. And just to get by, especially with my high standards, I constantly have to tell myself that I will have a clean house when I'm a grandmother. I will take more long contemplative walks when I'm a widow. I will have my best professional years as an old lady. That's what I remind myself when I look at my Social Security earnings thus far. So you can imagine that I read with interest Anne Marie Slaughter's article in Atlantic Monthly, Why Women Still Can't Have It All. Her message soothed me, and I knew that I'm okay. I'm doing the best I can. And it's not just good enough, it's darn good. When presidential contender Mitt Romney talked about his binder of women, I started my own, and I update it with each role model I find that speaks to me. I avidly follow glass ceiling issues, believing, no, knowing, that if I were a man, I'd be earning more. Because if I were a man, I wouldn't have taken a decade off of full-time work, and I'd likely be in a completely different job, a partner in a major law firm, or running a business or nonprofit somewhere. When Marissa Mayer took a paltry maternity leave and installed a nursery in her office, I was keenly interested. How could she do it? Would she be satisfied with herself as a person, as a mother, when she looked back from her golden years? And then Sheryl Sandberg comes out with her book, and no, I haven't read it because I'm too darn busy working and parenting full-time, and I'm fairly certain after reading a few reviews that it just might tick me off and make me feel inadequate. The national dialogue that has erupted since Mayer's telecommuting prohibition and Sandberg's leaning in has frustrated me. It hasn't inspired or motivated me, and it hasn't given me any relief, although it has made me and others question why work-life balance applies more to women than it does to men. Why is it that a woman executive who works and puts family on the back burner must be missing out on something, but a man who does so is a go-getter? Well, at least most working women and the national sentiment are as ambivalent as I about what constitutes success for the working mother. I don't yet regret taking time off the high-pressure, contentious career of my choosing to raise children. I was home with them during their formative years, and while I don't have time to bake with them now, and I dread kids' birthday parties, I still feel my lost decade was a good solid investment. Not in my net assets, not in my earnings potential, not in my publications list, but in my wholeness as a person. I've avoided my biggest fear, looking back at my mothering and blaming myself for shortcomings in my children, because I didn't take the time necessary to do a decent, if not perfect, job. The next generation now has a solid foundation of walks in the park, homemade science experiments, and family dinners. So I didn't make partner at a top firm by 40, but I might by 60, and my babies will be taking good care of their babies by then.
March Gallagher is an attorney and an expert in business and economic development. She lives in New York's Hudson Valley. Finally, a woman who changed our understanding of the world around us. Rachel Carson was a marine biologist and ecologist who started her career as a writer. That writing skill helped propel her best-known work, Silent Spring, onto the bestseller list and opened our eyes to the effect we have on our environment. Gilles Malkin has more.
Although many people become heroes in ways that touch many of us, few become champions of a cause that concerns us all. Rachel Carson was such a person. Carson was born in 1907 and raised in rural Pennsylvania. Fascinated by marine biology, she earned her master's from Johns Hopkins in 1932. She began by working as a writer for the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries and wrote articles on the subject of natural history for the Baltimore Sun. She then worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and eventually became their chief editor. However, she opted to follow her penchant for personal writing and published a book called The Sea Around Us that brought her international acclaim and admiration, revealing her ability to articulate a personal love for nature so purely that it caused everyone who read it to aspire to her level of appreciation of the wonders of nature. She had an ability to render scientific facts and observations into passionate and irresistible prose, and her book was a bestseller for over a year and a half. Once or twice in a generation, wrote the New York Times book critic, does the world get a physical scientist with literary genius? Miss Carson has written a classic. She became concerned about the agricultural employment of poisons and devoted herself to the task of warning us about their use, which brings us to her 1962 magnum opus, Silent Spring. This book, which endures as a living testament to her own undying respect and love for our planet, first appeared as a series of articles in The New Yorker and was published in its entirety by Houghton Mifflin the same year. The White House, Congress, and scientists all hailed the work and gave it the highest praise and attention. Carson was brought to testify before the U.S. Committee on Commerce. She received medals and honors and became a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. It was received differently, as you might imagine, by those who were being poisoned than by those who stood to benefit from the poisoning. The resistance from the industry was loud and nasty, and others who were not learned in the subject also objected to having to discontinue new and effective methods of controlling pests. The public were unaware that DDT and other like substances had been produced as military weapons for use in World War II, the ample stockpiles of which were now adapted to pesticide use for disposal. She explained that those substances do not stay where they're put and don't fade away once the task they've been given has been carried out. They can contaminate the countryside, poisoning animals and humans, as she discovered in long and painstaking research on a book she had not even planned to write. Silent Spring advocated for banning certain pesticides and restricting and regulating the use and volume of other questionable chemicals whose toxicity and destructive effects were apparent, and for the start of a new biotic approach to the control of harmful pests. She pointed to chemical industry propaganda and lamented the lack of questioning from those responsible for public health and safety. The expansion of environmental awareness began to snowball, and by 1969, the president was forwarded a congressional bill called the National Environment Policy Act, or NEPA. Its stated purposes were to declare a national policy which will encourage productive and enjoyable harmony between man and his environment, to promote the efforts which will prevent or eliminate damage to the environment and biosphere and stimulate health and welfare of man, and to enrich our understanding of the ecological systems and natural resources important to the nation. Remember, these were new ideas at the time, where there had existed no legislation before. In 1970, the Environmental Protection Agency became a living entity, and the war against pollution was launched. The story of its birth in itself is worth looking up and reading about, because it's so rare that such a concerted and concentrated effort was made and achieved, and don't think it's easy for Congress to do that. Quote, in fact, the EPA today may be said, without exaggeration, to be the extended shadow of Rachel Carson, unquote, wrote Jack Lewis in a 1985 edition of the EPA Journal. Since then, thousands of dedicated people have joined the fight, and many battles have been lost and won, but the consciousness against pollutants is stronger than ever today. And today, as even ordinary people continue to develop ideas and find practical solutions to progress without pollution, new ways of working with nature instead of against her are within our grasp. We have but to implement them. But Rachel Carson's story went much deeper. While she was writing the book in 1960, she underwent a radical mastectomy for breast cancer. She kept that story private, not wishing, as she said, to give the chemical producers any pleasure. But it was not cured, and she died of it in 1964 at the age of 56. In her final speech, Rachel Carson said, "Underlying all of these problems of introducing contamination into our world is the question of moral responsibility. The threat is infinitely greater to the generations unborn, to those who have no voice in the decisions of today, and that fact alone makes our responsibility a heavy one." It's become evident since her passing that she knew whereof she spoke. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.